So I told you last week, and then I also was talking to Bethany Miller. She's a teacher at the school where my children go, and I ran into her, and she was asking if I was going. She's attended here a couple times. I didn't see her, but maybe she's an overflow. And she asked if I would be continuing on in Joseph like Joel had been doing. And I said, no, I'll be preaching from Ecclesiastes. And she said, oh, the happy book. And so many of you probably, if you've been any time in Ecclesiastes, probably know it as maybe the unhappy book. But that's where my heart was, and so I wanted to share with you. In your notes, you'll see the year 2013. Probably not a significant year for you, but that was a year that Jill's grandfather on her dad's side passed away. And it marked a year, at least for Jill and myself, that all of our grandparents had now passed away. So it was, that kind of generation was gone. And so it was just my parents, Jill's parents, and our aunts and uncles. And I remember coming home from that trip to Arkansas after his funeral and just kind of being in a funk, just being down. And maybe some of you have experienced that yourself. And, I wasn't talking a lot about it, but Jill could sense something was wrong, and as wives probably sometimes do for other husbands, pulled out of me, what's going on, I was like, I don't know, it just feels like, and this was my, like we're on a big conveyor belt, like luggage going through an airport, and, we're just living our lives, and one day, our parents are going to be gone, then we'll be gone, we won't be around. That was my sense of it, just that sense of generation after generation. I know this is a very happy message for all of us. But I think that sentiment that, what's left in this life, that seeing the horizon, that day coming, is part of what Solomon is talking to us about in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, maybe some of y'all I know I'm a little bit of a different fruit than some, and so maybe you haven't thought about it that way, and I think maybe our culture entertains us more so that we don't think about it. In fact, there's a proverb inside Ecclesiastes where Solomon says, it's better to be in the house of mourning because it helps open our eyes to the real things than in the house of rejoicing. So, I've already said Solomon once, but Solomon, if we look at the context of the book, is traditionally have been thought to have written the book of Ecclesiastes. Some, if you go online or read some books, may raise some doubts as to his authorship. Did he really write the book of Ecclesiastes? Some of the things that they would point to is that there are some words and phrases used in the book of Ecclesiastes that were not common to Judaism at that time. They're from Persia, they're from Greece, and that doesn't bother me at all, knowing that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and most of those were part of, they were foreigners, and he was setting up treaties, he had visited a lot of people, so I don't think it'd be uncommon to think of Solomon as a well-learned, well-versed guy with other cultures, and maybe some of those phrases snuck into what he was writing. Also, if you just go ahead and open your Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes, if you're not already there. And if you look at that very first verse, the very first verse, it says the words of the teacher. And so another thing that folks point to as a concern that maybe he didn't write it was that there is this third person element that's there. So chapter 1, verse 1, chapter 12, verse 9. Kind of speaks about whoever is speaking as in the third person. And so, again, this doesn't bother me for Solomon's authorship. Sometimes, people talk about themselves in the third person. So it could just be a literary device, or it could have been someone after Solomon's death having, taking up his words and kind of putting them into a coherent book. But there's other clues about the writer of this that are very strongly in favor of it being Solomon. So if it's okay with y'all, we'll just proceed as though Solomon is the author. Everyone good with that? And so Solomon, you also have In verse 1, the words of the, and what do y'all have in your translations? The words of the preacher. You want to have teacher?
Teacher.
Anyone have anything else other than preacher or teacher? So that is a Hebrew word that is, let me find my notes, Kohelet. And it means one who gathers people together in an assembly to teach them something. So you can imagine why we have translated that either as preacher or teacher. And so that is who Solomon is. Now, if we recall much about Solomon, we know that he and Israel at this time were very, very, very rich. We can think back to the temple that he built, all the gold and the bronze and the silver that was there. If you read through the life of Solomon, countries during this time were giving him pounds and pounds and tons of precious metals every year as tribute. Solomon has a huge army that's put together, but he doesn't have to fight a whole lot of wars. David has done that for him. So we kind of think sometimes we talk about the Roman Empire and the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, but really Solomon had brought in to a peace of his own for Israel. And it seemed like Solomon had a Midas touch, right? Whatever he got into, whatever he pursued, it worked out for him. We know he is the author of lots of the Proverbs in our Bible. He also wrote Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. He was purported to be so wise that foreign dignitaries would show up, as I already mentioned, like the Queen of Sheba shows up and visits him. And like, what is this Solomon guy all about? He would be like a present-day lottery winner for us. Like, he's got it all. He's got everything. Anything that he wants to put his hand to, he can pursue that. So that is the author. So he's got a lot to say for us. And as we go through, we're just going to do an overview of the book of Ecclesiastes. We're not going to go, you know, I just said Ecclesiastes, but don't fear, we're not going to try to hit every verse in depth. But there are two phrases that are used over and over in the book of Ecclesiastes that we should be familiar with. And mine, the beginning of verse 2, says, "Absolute futility, says the teacher. Absolute futility, everything is futile." And so that is the CSB's rendering. And who's got vanity out there? Anyone got vanity? Some KJV, NKJV showing up? Who's got futility of futilities? No one has the NASB? That's futility of futilities? What's that?
Vanity.
It's vanity. Okay. All right. Meaningless NIV? Okay. So all of these words are trying to translate this Hebrew word, hevel. Hevel. And that is the Hebrew word for smoke or vapor. And when you think about what smoke and vapor is, if you ever had a cool fall morning, not very often in South Carolina, or winter morning, and you breathed out your breath, and you see that, and it's gone, right? That is hevel, and that is what Solomon is telling us everything is. Everything is hevel. It's like a breath in the morning. It's fleeting. It's enigmatic. You know, scientists, you know, we've modeled a lot of things. We understand how to, you know, put a satellite in orbit, we understand how to get to the moon, but modeling where that smoke is going to go in air currents is difficult for scientists to do. It's unknowable at some level. And when you think about that breath on that fall morning, what impact does that have? It's there, it's gone, no impact, it's meaningless, it's vanity. It's futile to try to understand that puff of breath. It's a vanity of vanities. And that's what Solomon says our life is. It's just a puff of breath. Here's smoke from a match. You know that we do know enough about smoke. If you've ever sat around a like little fire pit and the smoke always seems to follow you, there's a scientific reason for that. So that's not just in your imagination. That's actually there. All right, so the second thing that you should be aware of in the book of Ecclesiastes, and if you look at verse 1, chapter 1, 3, It says, what does a person gain for all of his efforts that he labors at under the sun? Under the sun. The phrase under the sun occurs 28 times and refers to the mortal world, this world that you and I are in. And when the preacher refers to all things under the suns, he's talking about our earthly, temporary, human things. And so lots of times we think about a sunny day, we kind of have something like this in mind, you know, clear skies, sun, breezy, we get to go enjoy things. For Solomon, it probably looked more like this. You would have that hot, arid, oppressive heat from the sun, and day in and day out, you're living your life in the desert under the sun. And the sun shows up, and it goes away, and it shows up, and it goes away, and that's life. For Solomon. That is life under the sun. All right, so a brief survey, and you can kind of flip through your Bibles as we talk about this, but all the things that Solomon tries to do under the sun, all of his pursuits, verses 10 through and 11 in chapter 1, he talks about scientific discovery, discovery of knowledge. Verses 13 and through 18, in chapter 1, philosophy and wisdom. Chapter 2, verse 1, he pursues mirth. Chapter 2, verse 3, he pursues alcohol. Chapter 2, verse 4, he pursues architecture. Chapter 2, 7, and 8, he talks about owning property, and we'll come back to some of these. Chapter 2, verse 8, he talks about luxury. Then he pursues different philosophies and meanings, such as materialism in 2, 19 through 20. And then he also pursues different moral codes in chapters 8 and 9. And then dispersed among all of Ecclesiastes, you'll find some little sections where it almost reads like someone took something out of Proverbs and put it in. But these Proverbs are just a little bit more weighty, the ones we find in Ecclesiastes, a little bit more solemn and sober, even the ones we find in the book of Proverbs. He finds that everything that he has done under the sun is meaningless. It's temporary. All of these pursuits that we read, they are nothing but hevel. Just a breath in the wind. All of that. So, throughout his book, he also has several conclusion statements. So, it's one of those books you read, comes to a conclusion, you read some more, it comes to a conclusion, you read some more. So, we're going to read through these conclusion statements. So our first one is found in chapter 2, starting in verse 24. So read this with me. So chapter 2, 24. There is nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I've seen that even this is from God's hand, because who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? For to the person who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give to the one who is pleasing in God's sight. This, too, is futile and a pursuit of the wind. So it sounded like we were getting some good news in there. We got some good, you know, happy sunshine. And then at the very end, he kind of gives a little jab. But, you know, this, too, is futile. But what would you notice that's kind of different? And if you read through Ecclesiastes, I think there's a stark contrast that's different about this little conclusion statement than all the places where he talks about being under the sun. God's mentioned. All the places where he talks about, I did this under the sun, this under the sun, this under the sun, and it was vanity, 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 God's left out of it. It's only in these little conclusion statements that he brings in. He's like, you know what? But we have to live in light of the fact that God exists and he's here. So here is my conclusion. Eat, drink, enjoy what God has provided for you, knowing that it's from his hand, but also knowing that it's a vapor. It's going to go away. Our next conclusion statement is in chapter 3, verse 9. So turn with me there. It says, what does the worker gain from his struggles? I've seen the task that God, again, has given the children of Adam to keep them occupied. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He also has put eternity in their hearts. But no one can discover the work God has done from the beginning. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and enjoy the good life. It is also the gift of God when anyone eats, drinks, and enjoys all his efforts. I know that everything God does will last forever. There is no adding to it or taking from it. God works so that people will be in awe of him. Whatever is has already been, and whatever will be already is. However, God seeks justice for the persecuted. So, again, Solomon is kind of coming to the same conclusion. We'll see this in most of his conclusions, that the goal of man is to enjoy the good that God has given us, knowing that it is for a season. I now turn over to chapter 5, verses 18. We'll pick up another one of these conclusion statements. We'll just read through all of these. We've got this one and one more. Solomon says, "Here's what I've seen to be good. It is appropriate to eat, drink, and experience good in all the labor one does under the sun during the few days of his life God has given him, because that is his reward. Furthermore, everyone to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also allowed him to enjoy them. Take his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God, for he does not often consider the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the joy of his heart." And then finally, in the end of the book, chapter 12, verse 13, "When all has been heard, the conclusion of the matter is this: fear God and keep his commands, because this is for all humanity. For God will bring every act to judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil." So I put all these verses juxtaposed to the picture of the temple, because it's in these verses that I already mentioned that Solomon is going to kind of step back from his depression, if you want to call it that, his dim view on life, and say, all right, but all of this has to be done in light of the fact that there is a God and he is reigning. All right, so that is an overview of the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm sure you want to go out and read it and imbibe it, and I would actually encourage that, but it's not one of those happy, peppy books. So given that, I do want to go over four different areas of foolishness or vanity that he goes over. So turn back to chapter 1, verse 12. Chapter 1, verse 12. So we all know, I think, the story of Solomon when he's a young boy. And he has this vision, this dream. And God says, ask of me. What do you want? And what's he asked for? Wisdom. And God says, because you asked for wisdom and you didn't ask for gold and for your enemies to be put down and long life, I'm going to actually give you all of those. I'm going to bless you beyond blessing. And so kind of the first part of Solomon's life as he's running as a young man, he is pursuing wisdom. We would maybe say wisdom to the hilt, to the nines. And he's going to come away from that feeling emptied, because I think he's pursuing wisdom as a way of fulfilling his needs, but wisdom ultimately cannot fill our deepest needs. So in verse 12, he says, "I, the teacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to examine and explore through wisdom all that is done under heaven. God has given people this miserable task to keep them occupied. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun and have found everything to be futile, a pursuit of the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, see, I've amassed wisdom far beyond all those who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has thoroughly grasped wisdom and knowledge. I applied my mind to know wisdom and knowledge, madness and folly. I learned that this too is a pursuit of the wind. For with much wisdom is much sorrow. As knowledge increases, grief increases." So what was Solomon's problem? He's pursuing wisdom, which is a great thing. I think we'd all agree to that, as an end unto itself. And he thinks that by learning everything he can and being as wise as possible, he's going to be fulfilled. And it ain't so. It ain't so. So where is he going to turn to next? I'll keep reading in chapter 2, verse 1. So do I have these? Here. Read these out of my Bible. So chapter 2, verse 1 through 11, he goes on to say, I said to myself, go ahead. I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy what is good. But it turned out to be futile. I said about laughter, it is madness. And about pleasure, what does this accomplish? I explored with my mind the pull of wine on my body, my mind still guiding me with wisdom and how to grasp folly until I could see what is good for people to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Now he's going to turn to achievements. I increased my achievements. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself and planted every kind of fruit tree in them. I constructed reservoirs for myself from which to irrigate a grove of flourishing trees. I acquired male and female servants and had slaves who were born in my house. I also owned livestock, large herds and flocks, more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. I also amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I gathered male and female singers for myself and many concubines, the delights of men. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also remained with me. All that my eyes desired, I did not deny them. That's a dangerous statement. I did not refuse myself any pleasure, for I took pleasure in all my struggles. This was my reward for all my struggles. When I considered all that I had accomplished and what I had labored to achieve, I found everything to be futile. In a pursuit of the wind, there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So we can see all that he does, and we kind of went over that in the overview. Great things. He's renowned for doing all those things, but in and of those selves, no meaning was to be found. This is a picture of Jack Whitaker. And there's several stories just like his, but I'll read. This is an excerpt from an article that was written about him. Jack Whitaker became an instant celebrity at 55 when he claimed what was then the largest lottery jackpot won by a single ticket in the United States. He opted for the lump sum payout of $113.4 million. That's a lot of duck land in Arkansas, after taxes. And he flew off to New York with his family in a private jet to appear on network television morning shows. But he quickly fell victim to scandals, lawsuits, personal setbacks, as he endured constant requests for money, leaving him unable to trust others. He was often quoted as saying he wished he had torn up the ticket. And if you read more, he dives into drugs and women and alcohol, all the things that Solomon would say he pursued, and it was empty. It was empty. There was no meaning found there for him. So we looked at wisdom. Solomon pursued wisdom, and it was empty. We looked at pleasure and possessions. Those were empty. Now Solomon's going to turn himself to work. So can we find meaning in our day-to-day work? Can we just pour ourselves into our work and be satisfied by that? So if we look at chapter 2, 18 through 23, Solomon says, I hated all my work that I labored at under the sun, because I must leave it to one who comes after me. So most of us, I think, we don't like work because it's labor. Solomon's like, I don't mind the work, but who am I going to give this? I got to trust this to, I guess, Rehoboam at that time. Maybe he already knew that he wasn't walking down the right path. But he had labored for all this stuff, and now he's going to have to pass it on to someone else. Verse 19, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will take over all of my work that I labored at skillfully under the sun. This too is futile. So I began to give myself over to despair concerning all my work that I had labored at under the sun. When there is a person whose work was done with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and he must give his portion to a person who has not worked for it, this too is futile and a great wrong. For what does a person get with all his work and all his effort that he labors at under the sun? For all his days are filled with grief and his occupation is sorrowful. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is futile. So I know we've all seen, like, the midlife crisis guy who's worked. He's in his late 50s and he's 60s. You look back, he's like, what was it all for? What was it all for? And lots of times, you know, our society will fill that in and will say, well, instead of pursuing his work, he should have pursued fill in the blank. And unless that answer has something to do with God in it, then that's still the wrong answer. Obviously, family can be a part of that, but it's in light of God. All right, so we talked about wisdom. We talked about possessions and pleasure. Work is not found in work. So let's flip over to the end of the book, chapter 12. And now he's going to talk about the vanity, the fleetingness of our lives. And he's going to use these words that we're going to see here in a figurative manner. And so I'll talk us through some of that. So picking up in verse 1, Solomon says, "So remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of adversity come, and the years approach when you will say, I have no delight in them." Just as an aside, I am fascinated by these birthday parties for people who are like 111 years old. I don't know if you've seen, you know, they start showing up a lot on posts. But I remember watching one, and they asked the lady, like, what do you hope to happen in the next year, you know, between now and your next birthday? She said, I hope I die. She was no longer enjoying her years. And I think that this is the sentiment that Solomon is expressing. And it was like, whoa, okay. Verse 2, end of verse 1, I have no delight in them too. Before the sun and the light are darkened, and the moon and the stars and the clouds return after the rain. So we're going to talk about a house, and he's going to talk, you know, there's different parts of a house, different parts of it, but all of these things kind of reference back to some part of our body or some part of our lives. So on the day when the guardians of the house tremble, and most folks think that these are our hands, we use our hands as our guardians, as fists or as ways, and the strong man stoop, most scholars believe he's talking about our legs, and the women who grind grain, be our teeth, cease because they are few, and the ones who watch, those would be our eyes, through the windows see dimly, possibly because of cataracts. The doors at the street are shut, those would be our ears, while the sound of the mill fades, when one rises at the sound of a bird, and the daughters of song grow faint. So there's some discussion about this one, but a lot of people think it's like, and I'm not there yet. Maybe some of you are there, where you wake up at 4 and you can't go back to sleep. Is that anyone? You don't have to raise a hand if that's you. But so when you wake up at the sound of a bird, and some people think that this end of it, all the daughters of song grow faint, maybe a reference to tinnitus in the ears, where you have that ringing, or it could be just the voice is going out and you can't sing anymore. Verse 5, also they are afraid of heights and dangers on the road. So they're, you know, you've seen someone who's frail, who's trying to walk. And the almond tree blossoms, speaking of whitened hair. And the grasshopper loses its spring. So you're just not as light on your feet anymore. And the caperberry has no effect. Now, the caperberry was thought to be an aphrodisiac. And so he's saying, hey, there's not even any sexual desire at some point as we age. For the mere mortal is headed to his eternal home, and mourners will walk around in the street. Before the silver cord is snapped, and a lot of people think this is either our spinal cord or just speaking of life in general, and the golden bowl is broken, this is our skull, and the jar is shattered at the spring, and the will, which would be our heart, is broken into the well. So all of these kind of ways of talking about our body, he's saying it's all shutting down. It's getting, you know, and I think as we get older, we experience that. I remember being young and thinking, these old people, you know, this will never happen to me. And of course, you know, as you all know, it does happen to all of us. Verse 7, and the dust returns to the earth, as it once was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. absolute futility, says the teacher. Everything is futile. Is that an accurate account of our lives? If lived merely under the sun, this is an accurate portrayal of our lives. All right, and so the last one of these meaningless vapors that I want to talk about is the vapor of time. And he leads with it, so we kind of skipped over it in the opening chapter, so back into chapter 1. I save it for last because for me, at some level, this is the most troubling. And I'll talk to you about that more. But who's familiar with the Myers-Briggs personality? I know, Tim, you love Myers-Briggs, right? Maybe not so much. But if I take the Myers-Briggs, I come out as an INTP. And so some of you may know what that is, and some of you not. And I think one of Tim's frustrations with it is it doesn't exactly nail who I am down, because I'm a lot more extroverted than a typical INTP. But one of the traits of an INTP is that we hate redundancy. We hate repetition. Routine, going to the same motions every day. We just want to get the point and move on, which this is not a good trait for a teacher, but there's a lot of teachers who are INTPs, right? So we have to learn to repeat stuff over and over and over again for everyone else out there because we expect you to get it the first time and let's go on to the next thing. But I can be weary with repetition, and that's just me. And so that's why this time thing, it's a little scary to me. So if we look at life under the sun without God, what does Solomon have to say about time? So we'll go back to chapter 1, verse 2. And this is how he starts off. Absolute futility, says the teacher. Absolute futility. Everything is futile. What does a person gain for all of his efforts that he labors at under the sun? A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun sets, panting, it hurries back to the place where it rises. Gusting to the south, turning to the north, turning goes the wind, and the wind returns in its cycles. All the streams flow to the sea, yet the sea's never full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome, more than anyone can say. The eye is not satisfied by seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Can anyone say about anything, look, this is new? It has already existed in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of those who came before, and of those who will come after, there also will be no remembrance by those who follow them. The eye is never satisfied. And of course, someone from modernity may say, well, they didn't have rocket ships back there, that's new. But the art of us inventing stuff and saying, this is new, that's been going on for years. The stuff that we invent is new, but it's just a cycle that goes over and over and over again. So this brings me to, and some of you saw this on Facebook maybe, Graham's number. And so having graduated with a degree in mathematics, I do want to talk to you a little bit about this. It is probably a common characteristic of mathematicians to get obsessed with some little thing and maybe make a big thing out of really something that's nothing. But there have been times when those little discoveries in mathematics have then mapped over to the real world. The imaginary number I is used all in electricity and stuff today. When we first talked about I as mathematicians, then it was like, who would we ever use this? But it does come up. So even for me, a mathematician, it seems like a trivial problem. So this guy, Ron Graham, was drawing squares and connecting them. And he was coloring them with only two colors, red and blue. And he wanted to know how many dimensions of the square he had to get before he could not avoid what we see over here, where all of the sides and the diagonals are the same color. So in one dimension, we can avoid that easily. We just paint one of them blue, we're good. Two dimensions, we can avoid it. Three dimensions, we can avoid it. Four dimensions, we can avoid it. Five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 12. We know that we can avoid it in all of those. We don't know about 13 dimensions because that number starts getting really, really, really big. So maybe we can't avoid it in 13 dimensions. But we don't know. So not being satisfied with this, he wanted to know that there was a number of dimensions at which we could prove that we could not avoid this from happening. And that number of dimensions is the so-called Graham's number. Now, this number is huge. You cannot, I cannot, this mathematician cannot comprehend the bigness of this number. When it was published in 1977, it was the largest number ever cited in a paper. And in fact, the Guinness Book of World Records picked it up and talked about it. There have since been larger numbers proven or used in proofs in mathematics. But this one was kind of that first one that kind of shocked everybody. So let's kind of talk a little bit about, get a taste for how big this number is. So if we were to be able to harness every subatomic particle in the universe, and so going back to chemistry, those would be electrons, neutrons, and protons, all 10 to the 80 of those, roughly, and we could use each one of them individually to like make a little number for us. So like, here's an electron making 0, and here's a proton making 1, and here's a neutron making 2. And we were to use all 10 to the 80 of those to spell out a number, we would not have enough numbers to show us how big Graham's number is. In fact, if we took every single one of those particles and changed it into a universe of its own with its own 10 to the 80 particles, and then we used that, now it's 10 to the 160, it wouldn't be enough. In fact, if we did that every second for however long you think the universe existed, so if you're an old earther or a young earther, it doesn't matter. If we did that, we changed every proton into a universe, and then we used its protons every second, it would not be enough to show how big this number is. That's Graham's number. It's a big number. Now, where are we going with all this? This is a big number, big number. Now, we just got through singing Home. I want to go home. But let me kind of level. Different home, different home. Let me level with you. Imagine an idyllic place where your loved ones are there. There's no sin. All your needs are met. And it just goes on and on and on and on and on. No God there. You are going to grow weary of that existence. Even with everything you can imagine, the weariness of that time, this is not Graham's number. This would be the last where it turns over and over and over again. That would be like Groundhog Day for us. It would be the same thing over and over and over again, right? And yet, brothers and sisters, we will live a Graham's number of years. That's a big, big number. What can redeem that? Maybe I should say, who can redeem that? There's only one person who can make that not be a misery to us, because we think we want to exist forever. But when we really start thinking about whatever is, I know like my wife and others have this ball of twine that has like a little red segment and it's supposed to show. That ball of twine is not nearly big enough to show how long forever is going to be. What is life without God? This is what Richard Dawkins says. In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe is precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. Now, this doesn't sound a whole lot different than what we read in the book of Ecclesiastes. And he, clearly as an atheist, is viewing life under the sun. Under the sun. And Paul's not very far from him either. Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 says, "And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is worthless. You're still in your sin. Those then who have fallen asleep in Christ have also perished. If we have put our hope in Christ for this life only, we should be pitied more than anyone." And that is, if it is true that we're living under the sun and we're not living for God, we don't have it, this life, as crazy as it is the best that it gets. Now, if we are living for God, we're living to pursue a relationship with Him, this life is still crazy, right? Would y'all agree? You've seen this stuff before. You've seen the wicked person get off scot-free, right? And the good person get punished. We've all witnessed that stuff. But this is the worst it gets. This is the worst it gets. David in the psalm said, "One thing I have desired, and that is to dwell with the Lord." So I think this is the conclusion that Solomon would have for us, despite our Sunday school on fasting. It is that we should, at some level, look around and see the things that God has given for us to enjoy here on earth and enjoy them while we can, knowing that they are from God. And it's fleeting. These earthly pleasures that we have are fleeting. They're futile. But they are what God has given us, and we look forward to a future home. Now, I think we could make this better a little bit if we had a tuba player serenading in the background. I mean, it would just one up the ambiance of it. But this picture is not complete, right? Because really what we need up there is not just enjoying family, and it's in the life under the cross, right? It's living that life where we are taking into account all that He has done for us. Turn to Colossians 1. We read through this last week while I was leading singing, when I kind of gave you a little preview of our sermon for today. Colossians 1. And if you read through Ecclesiastes, those little summary statements that we read at the beginning, it's the best that Solomon's going to give you, right? He's going to ask a lot of questions, and he's going to give you some little pieces of the answer. But you're not going to find a lot of, you're not going to come away from that, I don't think, if you just stay in Ecclesiastes with a full, I got it. But he's asking questions that Scripture will later answer in fullness. And we see one of those answers here in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. Let's read through this. "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For everything was created by Him in heaven and on earth, the visible and the invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through Him and for Him. He is before all things, and by Him all things hold together." We'll see that idea repeated in a little bit. "He's also the head of the body of the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that He might come to have first place in everything. For God was pleased to have all His fullness dwell in Him, and through Him to reconcile everything to Himself, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through His blood shed on the cross. Once you were alienated and hostile in your minds as expressed in your evil actions, but now He has reconciled you. He's made you right by His physical body through His death, to present you holy, faultless, and blameless before Him. He will reconcile everything to himself. Verse 20. And through him to reconcile everything to himself. And I just have a list of things here. Some of these are from my life, and some of these are things that maybe you've experienced. But I have, you know, that elementary school hurt that you have, that you can still remember as an adult today. Who's there with me? You got those? And then you're like, what? I'm a 44-year-old man. Why do I care about this? But it still bothered me back then. I can still think about it today. That will be reconciled. The job that you did not get, the dream that you had that went unfulfilled, a corrupt government, can I get an amen? Death that we're all going to experience, the just ongoingness of time that we already talked about, poverty, maybe having too much riches, sickness, suffering, anything that you can put on this list is going to be redeemed. It's going to be reconciled. It's going to be made right. Without God, this is the best we get. With God, this is the worst we're going to get. How is God going to do that for us? At some level, I don't know. Now, I think that's okay. Like, I'm a finite human. Like, I know that the level between, like, me and God is so vast that I'm trusting in him. If he said in his word that we're going to enjoy him forever, right, and all of our hurts and our tears are going to be wiped away, I trust that he can bring that about. The God who can speak the universe into existence can make all of those things right. He redeems all things. So let's close with this verse, verse 12, 13. When all has been heard, the conclusion of the matter is this: fear God and keep his commands, because this is for all humanity. For God will bring, and this is what we're talking about, his reconciliation, every act to judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil. He redeems all things. Now, I have on your notes two questions, because I know you, because I know myself, kind of what Danny was talking about a little bit in Sunday school a little bit. We all pursue these things. It's almost like we can't not. We pursue these things that are just idols to us, that we seek to get fulfilled by, just like Solomon did, other than our relationship to God. So what is that for you in your life? Because I have mine, you have yours. And then how can you shift your trust in being fulfilled from this empty pursuit over to a trust in being fulfilled by God? Probably Acts 2:42 is in the answer to that.